of Yazoo City, Mississippi, having graduated from Yazoo City High School in 1965. I have managed to get a hold of a copy of a high school yearbook. There it is, Haley. You want to take a look at it? Probably haven't seen that in a while. I can report to you, after perusing that, that he was a straight-A honor student, president of the student body, football and baseball letterman, and voted by his classmates as most versatile, and Mr. Yazoo City High School. If you get the impression, he's played up pretty big in that book. I think he was editor of that as well. Learned early. From there, he went on to Ole Miss, and then to Ole Miss Law School. Haley has had a long and distinguished career in public service. He started out working in various capacities for the Republican Party in the 60s in Mississippi, and that was back when there was not much of a Republican Party in Mississippi, or for any of the South, for that matter. Haley first appeared on the national scene during the Reagan years when he served as White House political director. I first met Haley subsequently when he was elected chairman of the Republican National Committee during the early Clinton administration. It was in those days that I became acquainted with his prodigious, even awesome, fundraising capabilities. You don't want to be standing in the way of Haley and a potential Republican donor. It was in that position as RNC chairman that Haley really became a national figure, and he knows and counts as friends more important Republicans and even some Democrats than practically anyone I know. Haley was elected the first Republican governor of Mississippi since Reconstruction in 2003, and he was reelected with 59% of the vote in 2007. He cemented his national reputation with his leadership in rebuilding his state in the aftermath of the worst disaster in American history, Hurricane Katrina. Since 2009, Haley has also served as chairman of the Republican Governors Association, and I've had the pleasure of working closely with him in that role. He and his colleagues in the RGA have successfully and masterfully presided over the most sweeping midterm election victory in modern American history. There are now 29 Republican governors in the United States. Haley has also become a good personal friend. In fact, we were just quail hunting together up in South Carolina yesterday, and like most Republican governors, he's a pretty good shot. Haley is a warm, outgoing person, but don't be fooled by that. He is sharp as a tack, and I don't know anyone who is more politically insightful. He is thinking about running for president, and if he does, he will be very much in the hunt. I know you will enjoy listening to him, so without further ado, let me introduce Haley Barbour.
Thank you. Joe, thank you very much. You know, you come to these deals, you don't know what you're going to run into. First of all, Carol Campbell, who grew up with me and we went to church together, could be the source of the high school annual. I look pretty good for, you know, I didn't have a gray hair in high school. It was interesting. But, you know, Joe said, come on, Haley, come on down to this deal. He said, it's really great. He said, there'll be some high school kids to talk. Nothing like that to follow. Ugh. You know, you may have heard one of the high school students was named Haley. And I thought, it's not very often that I'm the second best speaker named Haley at one of these deals. So, But good for you at the Forum Club. It's for me, it makes me feel great to know what y'all are doing for these high school kids for their futures. And I can tell you, those seven, every one of them's got a future. That's pretty obvious. And And I told the preacher, now, preachers need to be careful when they're doing this because I get to go last. I'm a Presbyterian myself, and I understand that Kurt grew up in the Presbyterian church and was ordained as a Presbyterian preacher. And, you know, H.L. Mencken said about Presbyterianism, it's the haunting fear that somewhere someone may be happy. But I thought it was a little much when we went from Hurricane Katrina to the oil spill and the needing defibrillators for my speech. I thought that was over and above the line, just to be honest. Well, let me just say, I'm tickled to be here. Naples is one of the great communities in the world, as far as I'm concerned. And when my wife was playing golf a lot, and one of the things we did together, we spent a lot of time here. And I'm honored to be here to speak to the Forum Club. I'm going to talk to you about current affairs, and I'm going to try to keep it fairly narrow because I'd like to save time for questions and talk mostly about this election that we just have. Joe alluded to it. And if you don't understand if I don't leave you with any other thought, this election in 2010 was the most policy-driven election I've ever been involved with. It was a massive repudiation of President Obama and the Democrat Congress's policies. It was about policy. It was about economic growth and job creation and how the policies of the administration in terms of spending, debt, deficits, energy, and health care all contributed to making the economy worse, all contributed to the uncertainty that made job creation harder. So I do want to try to keep on that focus. You know, I look around the room and I notice maybe some of y'all are old enough to remember Ed Sullivan. Okay, a couple of you. They say back in the 50s that one Sunday night with half of the American television sets turned to his show, Ed Sullivan had Conrad Hilton as his guest. Conrad Hilton at the time was a man who had just created a new industry in America, the luxury hotel chain. I mean, he was kind of the Bill Gates of his day, really, really, really sophisticated guy. And Ed Sullivan, in his way, says, Mr. Hilton, if you could only tell the American people one thing, what would you tell them? Hilton didn't hesitate. He said, put the shower curtain inside the tub. if I don't get anything else across, the one thing that matters to me is for us to understand, I know some of you may be Republicans, for us to understand when campaigns are about issues, when they're about public policy, that's good for Republicans. Has been my whole career, as Joe said, in 1968 when I dropped out of college to run 30 counties in the Nixon campaign. You know, if you're a Republican in Mississippi in 1968, you had to take the long-term view. I will tell you. But as we look at this campaign, look at the situation in our country, candidly, we better start taking the long-term view. Because our country is in a situation today that I suspect many of you never thought you would see. I can't tell you, we had 37 governor's races last year, and we won the vast majority of them. Today we have 29 Republican governors, as Joe said. 2 years ago we had 22. So Obama's been good for Republican governors, I can tell you that. But over and over and over, I saw people sophisticated, experienced, bright, successful people say, I'm scared. I've never seen an economic situation like this. I'm worried my children and grandchildren are not going to inherit the same country that I inherited. And that was very common among the very successful and the average American. The Tea Party movement is a function of that. These are, I don't know if you've ever been around a lot of Tea Party supporters. I have. And what you see is they're just everyday Americans, middle class, working class generally, who got scared enough they got up off the sofa and decided they're going to do something about it. And what was the it? It was outrageous, skyrocketing spending, explosive deficits, debt that our grandchildren are going to be paying off if we stop now. A health care bill that drives up the cost of health care. I mean, I can tell you, when we were talking about health care reform for 25 years in America, nobody thought what we end up with would make health care more expensive, would make government spending go up like it will by $1 trillion, and not very much said will put a huge burden on states. I have in my state today almost 600,000 people on Medicaid. When I became governor, by the way, there were 750,000, and we reduced the rolls to about 580, both by employment gains of about 70,000, which makes a lot of people get off the rolls because they don't qualify anymore. But the other thing we did, we started requiring people to recertify their eligibility in person. It's interesting how many never show up because they're not. There are a lot of people who weren't eligible. And we thought in my state it wasn't fair to make people who work two and three jobs to take care of their families and pay for their own health care then have to turn around and pay taxes to pay for other people's health care who could have worked if they had chosen to. Well, we're going to go to 900,000 to 950,000 people on Medicaid in Mississippi under Obamacare. It'll cost us in year 10 $443 million. That's 8% of our general fund just in the increase for the extra cost of Obamacare. These kinds of burdens are enormous burdens on the economy. People don't hire somebody because they don't know what it's going to cost them. I mean, in fact, if you look at major Obama policies and then look at the president's speech this week, the State of the Union speech, for me, it makes me scratch my head. First of all, in his speech, the president proposed trillions of dollars of new investments. That's the left's word for spending. What have we got out of the trillions of dollars of investment over the last 2 years? Well, if they haven't proven anything else, it is that a bigger government means a smaller economy. What we need in America is a bigger private economy, not a bigger government. And having a bigger government makes it much harder to have a bigger private economy. Start off, and the other thing, of course, that he said besides all this investment was we should freeze discretionary non-defense spending at today's levels. However, today's levels are about 25% above where they were 2 years ago. We've had a gigantic explosion in this spending. EPA's budget went up 125%. Other regulatory budgets up 85%. Just go down the list. Why should we freeze spending at today's level? Let's go back and freeze spending at 08 level. In 08, the government was spending about... In 08, the government was spending about 20% of GDP, 20.8. Today, in 2 years, The government is spending 25% of GDP, a near one-fourth increase in spending in 2 years. And what have we got for it? 9.5% unemployment. We have got a situation that is clearly unsustainable. And his idea of a freeze at these levels is actually harmful because it's deceptive. We need to go back to 2 years ago, and don't think it can't be done. I want to make plain to you a couple of things that actually happen. And that is, in state governments, we cut spending. You know, I can remember Karna and I were in the White House together. They missed her a lot more when she left than they missed me. I can tell you that. When we were in the White House, a spending cut, according to the Washington Post, was the budget of this department was supposed to go up 8%. It only went up 5%, so that's a 3% cut. Literally. Well, when we cut in state government, we mean it. It's for real, and it can be done. Last year, because of our state law allowing me to, I cut spending 9.4% in Mississippi. Overall budget, 9.4%. For the federal government, that's about a $350 billion a year cut. The B word's kind of hard for us governors. The T word is really tough for us governors. But I used to say, I don't believe anybody noticed. We cut 9.4%. And, of course, the liberals and the advocates and the news media all would criticize me for saying that, so I couldn't resist. We take a poll every year after the elections, kind of a post-election survey, and so I couldn't resist. Usually we put in our poll, were you affected by the spending cuts that the governor made? 14% said they were affected. More amazing to the press, but not to me, 52% said they didn't know there'd been any spending cuts. And the federal government can be cut, too. It's just a matter of willpower. And in my view, nothing should be off limits. You know, very strong defense state, big defense contractors. The Defense Department can be off the table. They can save money at the Defense Department just like they can save money at any other department and agency in the federal government. I'm not the only one. Governors cut spending. Karna and I were in the White House with Mitch Daniels from Indiana. Gave Indiana the first balanced budget in 8 years without raising anybody's taxes. Bob McDonnell in Virginia last year inherited a more than $2 billion deficit without raising anybody's taxes. They're going to have a more than $400 million surplus in Virginia this year. It goes on and on just by having the willpower to do what's got to be done. And I will say to you, I think the American people are ready for that. I think the American people are ready for some plain talk. I used to say when President Clinton was president, I was chairman of the Republican National Committee, you got to trust the people enough to tell them the truth. And I think the people are quite ready to hear the truth and have a little bit more of a long-term view about where our country's going. Because, as Paul Ryan said the other night, we are in danger of a tipping point that we cannot get back from. And we better not wait till that happens. So spending, in my mind, more than deficits offended the American people. And they responded to that in this election. You know they can't spend themselves rich. And the government can't spend itself rich either. They also understand very well, we don't have the announcement yesterday by the Congressional Budget Office is that the deficit this year is going to be $1.5 trillion. When I was in the government, the budget wasn't $1.5 trillion. And to give you a little frame of reference here, we're talking about spending $3.8 trillion and taking in $2.3 trillion. It's not like $15 trillion versus $13.5 trillion. We're talking about a 40% deficit. that we're going to run this year. Now, not anybody here got rich doing that. I can tell you, and our country can't do it either. And we don't have $1.5 trillion deficit because we tax too little. It's because we spend too much. That is why raising taxes is not the answer. Our old boss, Ronald Reagan, used to say, never forget, raising taxes is the enemy of controlling spending. If you raise taxes, they're going to spend it. And I don't care if they're Republicans or Democrats or mugwumps. If you give them the money, they're going to spend it. We've got to get control of spending. That's the only way to bring down the deficit in a meaningful way. It's the only way to start putting a limit on the debt. And by the way, we have a debt ceiling vote coming up in the next few weeks, certainly this spring. And to me, Republicans who are not running the government, and let's don't forget that. I think one of the problems Republicans had in 1995 and 6 is a lot of people got to thinking that we were in charge, that we were running the government. Well, Republicans today have the control of one house, and the Democrats have control of the other, and they have the president. So that people's expectations don't get out of whack, don't think that we can go change everything. Now, we ought to be able to keep more bad stuff from happening. We ought to be able to nibble around the edges at defunding some things. We ought to be able to put sunshine on the regulatory regime of the Obama administration, a subject to which I'll return because I think it's enormously important in what we're doing. But we can't go out and pass laws. You know, we can't save $500 billion unless Obama agrees. And that's where the debt ceiling vote comes in. I do think that is an opportunity for us to deal with the president in a way that he doesn't get a debt ceiling increase until we get some serious cuts. And that ought to be the starting place for what we're doing. But all this spending has not resulted in employment growth, or economic growth for that matter. I saw a table in a news magazine the other day. In the first 2 years of Obama, government employment went up 9%. Well, to me, that's not what we're trying to get. Private employment went down 7 million. 7 million Americans. And when you consider the underemployed and the people who've quit looking, our real unemployment rate is very, very high. And the way to do something about that is put more money back in the private economy. Raising taxes is exactly the step in the wrong direction. But the other big issue for Obama and the economy has been what he's tried to do in regulatory policy. Cap and trade. Energy policy. We can talk about it more later if you want to, but I'll just say one thing that I think is critically important. The president said last night, or whatever night it was, time flies when you're having a good time, right? He said that we need an energy policy in America. Regrettably, Obama has an energy policy. His policy is to drive up the cost of energy so people will use less of it. That's an environmental policy. But that environmental policy under Carol Browner's strong right hand is the policy of this administration. They want to reduce emissions, and they know the truth of it is that you cannot do that unless you're going to take great risk with the economy. Because economic growth and energy usage has been related and have been related in this country for 400 years. From the time the British pulled up at Jamestown, we have had abundant, affordable energy supplies. And we've built our economy on that. That's been part of our comparative advantage. Affordable, abundant, reliable energy. Every Obama energy policy is a move away from that. Whether it's trying to stop hydraulic fracking to get into the Marcellus sands, which is the huge growth in unconventional natural gas production in the United States, to the permatorium on drilling offshore in the Gulf. Let me say, yeah, we're one of the four states that has allowed drilling for more than 50 years. 31,000 oil wells drilled in the Gulf of Mexico in those 50 years. One time have we had an incident like this, and it is clear and has been clear from the first week that it happened because they cut corners. They didn't follow the normal protocols, that they didn't do what they normally did. This, look, we didn't need a panel to go figure out what to do, what was wrong and what needs to be done. We just need to follow the ways that we've done this in the past. Yet at the same time that they're trying to shut in the Gulf, and by the way, the Wall Street Journal predicted last week, U.S. oil production will go down 19% this year. Because we get 25% of our natural gas and over 20% of our oil from the Gulf of Mexico, offshore. And deep water is increasingly part of that. Yet at the same time, the Obama administration lends money to Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company, to drill off the shore of Brazil in much deeper water and far deeper wells. And have you heard one complaint about the Chinese National Oil Company drilling off the shore of Florida in Cuban waters? No. But they got their policy is more expensive energy. And don't take my word for it. In 2008, then-candidate Senator Obama told the San Francisco Chronicle, under my cap and trade plan, electricity rates will necessarily skyrocket. His words. True. Truer words never spoken. His energy secretary, Dr. Chu, said the same year, what we really need in America is to get the price of gasoline up to where it is in Europe. Well, they may need that in California, but $4 gasoline brought my state to its knees in the summer of 2008. And as we go past $3 gasoline now, it is a product of the policies of this administration. I tell people, as long as I'm governor of Mississippi, we got our own energy policy, more American energy. And that's what the policy of the United States should be, more American energy. All of the above, oil, gas, coal, nuclear. Let me just say, we build solar panels in Mississippi. We have the first commercial-scale carbon capture and sequestration at a coal-fired power plant in North America in Mississippi. We've got a company that is attempting to make bio-crude out of wood chips, something, by the way, the Germans did during World War II, just not to much scale. We're very into alternatives. We're into conservation and efficiency, but you got to have all of the above. And anybody here who thinks we won't be burning oil and coal in your grandchildren's adult life, just simply not well informed. We cannot tolerate an energy policy that drives up the cost of energy, because that will drive all manufacturing, all significant manufacturing, to Brazil and Russia and India and China and Korea. I mean, that's what our economy is facing, to have to overcome really bad policy. The Dodd-Frank bill. You know, I never thought you could get a financial services reform bill after the 2008 crash that ignored the principal cause of the 2008 crash, Fannie and Freddie, and the mortgage explosion, to some degree, if not totally, caused by Congress for mandating that these people make bad loans, for mandating that there be a reduction in quality of credit, and then to be shocked, that some of these people couldn't afford to pay their loans. It kind of reminded me of Humphrey Bogart, And what the French lieutenant said? Well, y'all all remember the story, y'all. You've got to deal with real policy if we're going to deal with the problems. It isn't about rhetoric. It isn't about hope and change. It's about good policy yields good results. I also am of the Reagan school that I think good policy is good politics. That at the end of the day, what people judge you on are results. And if you follow good policy, you'll get good results. And if you follow bad policy, you'll get what we got now. And we got to try to do something about it. Let me close before I take questions by saying this. I'm from Mississippi, as Joe said. One of my fellow Mississippians, and one of the people I really look up to, Fred Smith. Fred was born in March, Mississippi, founded FedEx, is still the chairman and CEO of FedEx. And Fred's got some good Fredisms, one of which is this. The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. You know, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And the main thing is the right kind of policies. But to get that done in the American system of government means you have to win the election. I remember Carol, in 1975, the closest we had ever come to electing Republican governor in Mississippi, our candidate Gil Carmichael, a month before the election, some woman had shot at President Ford. He had this, I don't know what, probably can't say in front of the ladies, but he had a bad thought and came out generally in favor of gun control, in favor of gun registration. This is not a real popular subject in Mississippi. I said, Gil, what in the world are you thinking? He said, well, you know, Haley, I just felt like I had to be a statesman. And I said, well, Gilbert, the problem is you can't be a statesman until you hold an office of state. And you ain't about to have one. To get good policy, we have to win the election in 2012 like we did in 2010. Because you can't change policy in a big direction back in the direction we had been in for decades and decades in America without having the White House. So I want to close with just a thought on politics that I think is really important for my party, and I hope will be something that you can take with you. 2010 election in the run-up, it was talked about all the time how the Republicans were intense, enthusiastic, mad, fired up, the Tea Party movement, all this energy, and all that was true. I'd never seen anything like it. It was more than 1994 when I was chairman of the party, and I never thought I'd see that. In this case, it started earlier, and I worried the whole time that it was going to kind of burn out, but it didn't. We elected governor in Virginia, governor in New Jersey, elected Scott Brown in Massachusetts, and it kept its energy. It really never gave out. But let me tell you a statistic that you're probably not familiar with. According to the exit polling on November 2nd, 37% of the vote was cast by people who identified themselves as Republicans. 37% of the vote was cast by people who identified themselves as Democrats. That the number of people actually voting was essentially the same. That a higher percentage of Republicans turned out because there's slightly more Democrats than Republicans. But the fact of the matter is we won a big victory because we carried the independents by about 20 points. And why is that so important? Because that's where American elections are normally won, in the middle. Now, in America, the conservative side is about 40%, and the liberals are about 20% in terms of self-identification, and about 40% identify themselves as moderate. So conservative liberal is not Democrat Republican, because there are a good number of conservative Democrats. But some people have the election pegged for 2010. We won because we blew them out in turnout, and the Democrats stayed home. That's simply not true. The Democrats generated their turnout, particularly in the big cities, with huge amounts of money, organization, typically union muscle, but they turned out. Parts of urban Philadelphia had a bigger turnout in 2010 than in 2008. 2008 presidential election, the biggest turnout in American history by a pretty good margin. Yet in some urban areas, the Democrats matched or exceeded that turnout. Not by enthusiasm, not by intensity, but organizationally, mechanically, through money. So we need to understand, not only did independents win this election for Republicans, if we're going to elect a president in 2012, independents are going to have to elect that president. I don't care who the Republican is, whether I run or whether it's somebody else, we have to win independents, which is why we have to be very careful as we deal with our base, that we vote for what we said we're going to vote for, that we do just what we said. But we don't need people out pounding on their chest. I used to tell Newt, act boldly but speak temperately. You know, there's nothing the news media likes better than to make a conservative sound shrill and intolerant. And, of course, they hate it when our side has a sense of humor. I mean, that just kills them. Judy Woodruff used to grit her teeth when she interviewed me when she was still at ABC. But our party, our candidate, we've got to understand we've got to attract those people in the middle. Most of them on the issues we're talking about are about as conservative as you are. And it was a great blessing for us that the election in 2010 was almost exclusively about economic growth, job creation, and the effects of spending, debt, deficits, energy, health care. Because the more divisive issues among our base, the Democrats couldn't stir the pot with. So I hope that you will take that thought home with you. In politics, purity is a dead dog loser. Unity wins elections, because politics, after all, is about mathematics. It's about addition and multiplication, not division and subtraction. Thank you for letting me be with you.
Thank you, Haley. That was terrific. I think it's what everybody came to hear. We got a lot of questions and not too much time, so let's have right at it. The first one is on immigration. There were several. What is your feeling on what we do about all these undocumented aliens, many of whom are right here in this county?
The first thing you have to do is seal the border. Until you control the border, there cannot be an answer, because there are a lot of people that are simply not going to vote for anything until the border's sealed. And after all, the first indicia of nationhood is to be able to control your own borders. I am not nearly as hard over on immigration as a lot of Republicans. Part of the reason for me is after Katrina, when my coast was obliterated, we had 100,000 homes in the state uninhabitable, including 70,000 on the coast. We had a lot of Spanish speakers who came into the coast, who lived in tents, lived in the woods, lived in pickup trucks, who came in and helped us rebuild. because the people that would normally have been building houses, they'd lost their houses too. And so we needed those people. And I think we have to also understand we are not going to deport 12 or 14 million people. We're not going to arrest them and put them in jail. But H-1B visas, another immigration issue, very important that we start keeping more of the people we educate here and give PhDs in mathematics and engineering, and they finish at Stanford, get a PhD, and we make them go home to Mumbai, where they start a business that employs 1,500 people. Why can't we let them start a business in Mobile that employs 1,500 people? I mean, I was born at night, but it wasn't last night.
All right. Moving on, a lot of questions about the Tea Party. I know you spoke about it, but I think the gist of them is the Tea Party was instrumental in November, but going forward, are they going to be a positive or a negative for the party?
I think overall it's a positive. First of all, it did give our party a lot of energy. A lot of these people had been Republicans or had voted Republican, not all of them, but a lot of them, and it got them back involved. I think there has been a special premium in the last 2 years on information. I see people, whether it's Fox News or whatever, that are much better informed about specifics and details than I've ever seen before. And I actually think that's healthy. I really do believe the more elections are about issues and policy, the better we do. The more elections are about emotion, the better the Democrats do. Usually they got the bumper sticker, we got the essay. And I think the Tea Party's helpful there. Clearly, we lost one, probably two Senate seats because the Tea Party candidate won the primary in Delaware. Christine O'Donnell used to work for me. Let me just say that. But Mike Castle was a shoe-in. The Democrats would have punted on Delaware, and he lost the primary. So instead of getting Mike Castle, who votes right 80% of the time, we got a Democrat who won't vote right 8% of the time. And as President Reagan used to say, never forget a fellow agrees with you 80% of the time, it's your friend and ally. He's not some 20% traitor.
Okay. Of course, a lot of questions about the upcoming presidential election, and I'll just give you a two-part one. Who are the top five in terms of competence and electability potential candidates? And if you decide to run, will you overcome the perception that you are a Washington insider?
Well, I can't deny I'm a Washington insider. I've been chairman of the party, chairman of the Governors Association, political director of the White House. I'm not going to get my virginity back. which is not to, I'm also a lawyer, a politician, and a lobbyist. That's the trifecta. I actually think the American people want somebody as president who can get things done. And to me, lobbying is simply a different form of advocacy. And every day the president gets up, whoever gets elected president on January 21st, is going to be advocating to Congress, advocating to the public, advocating to the business community, advocating to the labor unions, advocating to foreign governments, friendly and unfriendly. That's what presidents do for a living, is they effectively lobby other people to try to do the right thing for America's interest and the world's interest. And I'm not going to walk away from the idea that I might actually know how to do some of this.
The top five candidates.
Oh, thank you. Look, it's not fair for me to handicap the field. Every one of these people are friends of mine, and I ain't got anything bad to say about any of them. Never speak ill of a fellow Republican is a familiar idea, right, Carla? And so I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay. The U.S. dollar is the currency of the world as far as trade goes. With the ever-increasing national debt, do you think the dollar can maintain its status as the standard currency?
It's a very serious question. I asked Bernanke that 3 years ago. The fact of the matter is we are cheaper than our own currency. The Chinese are chewing on this very issue, that they don't like the fact that we're the reserve currency of the world. Now, the Chinese economy is about 40% as big as ours. Now, you know, people tend to forget our economy is 2.5 times bigger than theirs. But the fact is, you see speculation in petroleum, particularly today, that is based on currency values and not based on supply and demand of oil. And the $90 oil is a product of a weakening dollar that is suspect. Not a soul in this room has, in their adult life, been in an environment when the dollar wasn't the reserve currency. And I hate to think of what the effect would be on our economy, particularly because we have been, for the last 40 years, such a debt-driven society, and I mean that privately as well as government, if we weren't. So we better, I view that the Fed needs to move very much back into trying to have a strong dollar or a dollar that is not being speculated against as a minimum.
All right, here's a different one. Are you willing to acknowledge the Republican responsibility for so much of the reckless spending, the unfunded costs of what this questioner regards as misguided wars?
Well, clearly in the last couple of years of the Bush administration, spending spiked up. It's the reason we lost the election in 2006. People who voted for us in 2000, 2004, frankly, people that voted for us in 1994 when I was chairman, didn't think we were being faithful to what they had voted for. So they either didn't vote or they voted against us. We got beat because we deserved to. But if you look at what Bush allowed to happen and then what the Obama administration has striven for in terms of spending, it really does pale. They make it unimportant because, well, let me just close on this thought by putting it this way. The 2010 election was a repudiation of Obama's policies. It was not an embracing of the Republicans' policies or of the Republicans. It was purely the public saying, all right, we're going to give you all another chance. And if you don't do better, we're going to kick you out again. And I think we have to look at this election exactly that way. We have been given a chance to redeem ourselves because the other guys did so much worse.
Okay. Many people outside of the Beltway believe both parties are controlled by the far end of their party. How will you and the Republicans seek to gain those of us in the middle?
Well, the fact of the matter is the way congressional districts are gerrymandered, it leads to this. Most Republican districts are very safe districts. Most Democratic districts are very safe districts. The primary is won by the person who can most appeal to the base, which in the Republican Party is going to be to the right of our center, and in the Democratic Party to the left. I mean, let me just tell you, when I was in the government with Corrin and Reagan, Nancy Pelosi, Barney Frank, Henry Waxman, those people were considered nutcases. I mean, they were the left lunatic fringe, and I'm talking about by the Democrats. However, they got the safest districts, and now all of a sudden John Conyers is the chairman of Judiciary. I mean, if you can imagine. When Charlie Rangel is the most centrist-minded member of the Democrat leadership, it gives you an idea about how this works. But it is true. But the fact is, presidents are elected by the middle. And that is just the way, the truth of it. And you got to learn, figure out how to win the nomination without going too far to the left if you're a Democrat, to the right if you're a Republican.
Okay, last question. You all have seen in the news that there's some real turmoil now in the Middle East, in Egypt and Tunisia and so forth. What's your take on that?
Bad, probably going to get worse. You can go back a couple of years, and the move of Turkey toward Iran and away from Israel was a real harbinger of where we were headed. The influence of the Iranians for the Turks, who had been a very, very powerful and important ally for us in Europe, and the move under Erdogan toward Iran, the Turks' effort to start sort of an economic sphere in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, tied again to Iran. Hezbollah having the government in Lebanon is very, very scary. And to see Mubarak, who has been, by all appearances, the Rock of Gibraltar, see him under attack, you know, I'm not an expert enough to know whether his government will fall or whether they're going to chip away. But Egypt and Turkey have been very secular Muslim countries. And they have the Coptic Christians in Egypt have not suffered much in the way of persecution, and none by the government. But the real question is Yemen and the foot of Saudi Arabia, because those are same people in many ways. And if you don't have the big oil states, then you could have a crescendo over there. And in my opinion, almost all driven by Iran.
Good. Karen Ailey, that was terrific. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Governor. I think this will be a forever memorable presentation. Thank you for sharing your wisdom and for sharing your...